A young man pledged his undying love to his beloved. He said, "I would climb the highest mountain for you, cross the hottest desert. I would sail the stormiest seas. And I can't wait to see you tomorrow night, unless it's raining." It was St. Francis of Assisi who said, "At all times, preach the gospel, and if necessary, use words." Words alone, as they say, talk is cheap, action speaks louder than words. And in our next scripture reading, we're going to read a story about a woman who uses no words at all, but preaches something of God's love and allows her story to be heard by Christ in a way that is preserved indeed in the Gospels. Listen now to this extraordinary event that takes place in the last week of Jesus' life. While Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at the table, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment of nard. And she broke open the jar and poured the ointment on his head. But some were there who said to one another in anger, "Why was the ointment wasted in this way? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and the money given to the poor." And they scolded her. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has performed a good service for me. For you will always have the poor with you, and you can show kindness to them whenever you wish, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for its burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her." May God bless to our hearing and to our living this reading from God's holy word. John Bunyan, the renowned Christian author who wrote The Pilgrim's Progress, reflected on his conversion to Christianity with these words. He said, I was so taken with the love and mercy of God that I knew not how to contain myself. Have you ever had an experience of something that touched you so deeply, moved your heart, shook your world in a way that you really couldn't figure out quite how to hold it all? I know for me, I still think back at a time when I was 13 years old, I went to a week-long Christian camp. The last night of the camp, we were gathered around the campfire. It's kind of that traditional thing where you're singing Kumbaya and other songs, and I wasn't really moved by any of it, you know, all week. But then we started singing this song, "For Those Tears I Died," and somehow, some way, my heart just kind of split open. And I began to feel this strange sense of God's presence, and I began, a 13-year-old boy, to weep, which was a very unusual situation. I didn't know how to respond. My body just kind of took over and said, "We'll respond this way." I had a similar experience at the birth of each one of my children, just standing there, just finding myself watching something that was so miraculous and beautiful and transformative that I just didn't know quite what to do except to cheer on Jennifer as she was giving birth. I remember backpacking in a Colorado slot canyon a few years back, just moving through the landscape, and suddenly I became aware in a very mystical way that everything was pulsating with life. And I was so grateful just to be a part of it, to see this canyon, to notice those trees. But you don't need to be in places of natural beauty or the birth of children or even at a Christian camp to have your heart warmed The great Christian mystic and author Thomas Merton wrote about a time where he sensed the veil separating us from the transcendent being removed. He said, in Louisville, Kentucky, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all those people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be aliens to one another, even though we were total strangers. You could be walking through mire, you could be driving your car, and all of a sudden there might be this experience where something happens and you become aware of something deeper and more profound than you could ever imagine is there for you. The Gospels don't say what moved this woman to this act of profound love and gratitude, but certainly it was centered on Jesus. Perhaps he had healed her, or perhaps she had heard one of his teachings. Perhaps, we don't know, perhaps she had a deep illness or whatever it might be, but something moves her and she decides, I gotta find a way to express somehow something of what I'm feeling, of this gratitude and love for this Jesus. She couldn't be contained even by the cultural prohibitions of her day, which would have taken a very strong response to the fact that she was showing up as a woman uninvited to an all-men dinner party. She decides she's going to walk in. And it was the custom in that day that when an honored guest came to your house, you would put maybe a drop or two, just a dab of an ointment or a perfume on them to just bless them, to anoint them. But she shows up. She's not there to give Jesus a dab of perfume. She brings this entire jar, this flask of this ointment that's made of a root found in India. The scriptures say that it was worth 300 denarii, 300 days of what a laborer would earn. So almost a year's worth of wealth she's carrying with her. Now, for a woman in that culture, we don't know if she's married. My guess is she's not. You can imagine that this was a family heirloom guaranteed to provide some sort of security, a safety net. It was her social security. It was her 401k plan, or IRA, all held in this precious jar of ointment that would get her through any potential hard times. And she brings this to Jesus. And she cracks it open and just pours it on his head. She couldn't hold back. She had to give him something that was precious because what he had done for her was so meaningful and so beautiful. A biblical scholar, William Barclay, says, if love is true, there must always be a certain extravagance in it. Love is not concerned to see how little it can decently give. I love that. Love does not sit around calculating, well, what's the minimum amount I can get by with? Love has this, oh my gosh, we got to give a lot. We got to be extravagant. We got to be generous. He says, if it gave all it had, the gift would still be too little. There is a recklessness in love which refuses to count the cost. I love that. There is this recklessness in love that refuses to count the cost, and this woman certainly had a recklessness to her, and it made the disciples uneasy. Mark shares almost immediately. They get together and they start grumbling. Oh my God, what a waste of resources. I mean, look at this. This ointment could have been used. It could have been sold. We could have had a lot of benevolence money to give, you know, to give to the poor who would have had meals to eat. And they began to scold her. That's the biblical way of saying that they were mansplaining to her what she should have done with her own assets. Let us tell you what you should have done with what you brought here. Because we know we've been following Jesus, after all, and we know exactly what he would want. He would want that money to have been sold and given away to the poor. How dare you be so stupid and so reckless in what you're doing? And Jesus puts an end to that. Stop it. This story is told in all four Gospels. In some versions it says, she has done an extravagant thing. She has done a beautiful thing for me. I'm grateful. See, she understands something. She understands something about Jesus and about grace and about gratitude that these disciples, after 3 years of following around, still don't get. They're still trying to figure all this out in their heads. What are the rules to follow? What are the customs to do? What is the right thing? And she just responds from this inherent, powerful sense of profound gratitude for what Christ has done. And she knows, I have to express this. What she understood, I think, was in the heart of a story I heard about the Teresa in Calcutta, where she was caring for many people who were on the streets. Many of them had leprosy. Many of them had diseases that were horrible. And she would have people who would come in, you know, to kind of be there for a while. People on mission trips, perhaps, would watch the work of her and her sisters. The story one time of a very wealthy man who came by. He had a heart for caring for the poor, and he was watching her clean out a wound that was gangrenous. And he said to her, I wouldn't do that for $1 million. And she said, neither would I. I'm not doing this for money. I'm doing this because my heart is so in love with God that I find that when I care for this person, I realize I'm caring for the body of God. It's love that motivates me to do this. Maybe reckless, maybe crazy, but there's something about the logic of love. It's hard for the mind to grasp. The mind and the heart often don't speak the same language. And we typically are people who follow our minds, who allow reason, rationality, what makes sense to guide us. And often I'm sure that steers us well, but there's also this thing that we've been given called the heart, that we were given by God because God has a heart. God is not a giant computer program who simply operates out of algorithms of logic and rationality. God is a God who is passionately love. And so sometimes, you know, we do things that maybe don't make sense to the mind. I was thinking about when my parents died. You know, my dad had this old player piano. It's not the beautiful, most beautiful thing in the world. It's not finished very well. And yet, I felt, you know, I really want that player piano to move from my parents' house in Southern California to my house, our house in Michigan. And it's not cheap to have a piano shipped, you know, across country when you moved here. It would have been far cheaper, I'm sure, if I really wanted a player piano, to have bought one close by. But there was something about the fact that this was my dad's, and he was now gone, that my heart said, I want this piano. There was this sort of longing, you know, to have something of him that reminded me of him, that made me smile about him close by. And I'm sure if we all look in our own lives, we find moments where we did something that maybe wouldn't have made sense if your heart wasn't consulted, but at times when the heart says, no, you've got to listen to this. You've got to do this. You have to pay attention to what I'm saying because this is so important, so crucial. I think we often begin to listen to our hearts around the holiday season. You know, we sort of decide we're going to fly out somewhere or drive somewhere for Thanksgiving or Christmas. We're going to put ourselves in an airport where there are 40 million people standing in line, and we're going to submit ourselves to that so we can fly across the country and spend 5 hours or a day with family that, once it's done, will remember, well, that's why I left home in the first place. And we do it year after year, knowing it's going to be the exact same thing as the previous year, but we got to do it because something in our hearts has this connection to family and a longing for connection, and so we're going to do it. The heart and the mind often don't make any sense. And yet sometimes the most beautiful and extravagant thing you can ever do comes from an impulse of the heart. Again, the disciples thought she was crazy. She was wasteful, but Jesus looks at her and has a very different opinion. It's beautiful. It was extravagant. And I'm wondering if the reason why Jesus responded that way is maybe he was seeing in her something mirrored back to him of his own heart. That she was letting him see something of his own nature in what she was doing. Because not long after this dinner party, Christ is going to pour out not a flask of perfume, but blood out of his own body. He was going to give everything that he had. Something far more than a year's worth of wages. He was going to pour out his very life, but in the same motivation that she did, because his love for us, his devotion to restoring us would be so profound that he would decide, I've got to break open not a flask, but my body. I'm going to allow myself to be tortured and killed. Why? Not because it makes any sense, but because there's this love of God that compels me to do that. And we as Christians, you know, believe that this pouring out of the blood of Christ was what manifested the love of God in the most profound, transformative way. And this God then pours out life on Easter morning, pours out the Spirit on Pentecost, pours out grace and mercy and love every moment of every day. It is the ongoing grace and love of God that keeps this world moving, that keeps our blood pumping, that keeps everything happening. And God pours all this out, not because it makes sense to God. I mean, God, I think, every day wakes up and he has, you know, 8 billion children that are many times breaking his heart, hurting one another, causing God such grief and anguish. Like, why would God do that? Why would God care? Why would God die for us? Why would God be so committed to us, except that God is love? And love doesn't count the cost. If it did, Christ wouldn't have died on the cross. God would say, no, that's too much. That's too much. But I got to do it. Because my heart compels me to. And maybe, just maybe, this woman is mirroring back to Jesus that kind of love. He said, you get it. You understand. Thank God you understand. Because these disciples, I've been with them 3 years, they don't understand. It's a beautiful thing because she's mirroring the beautiful heart of God. The great Persian poet Rumi put it this way. He says, love is reckless, not reason. Reason seeks a profit. Love comes on strong, consuming herself unabashed. Yet in the midst of suffering, love proceeds like a millstone, hard-surfaced and straightforward. Having died to self-interest, she risks everything and asks for nothing. Love gambles away every gift God bestows. And I share all this because for so much of my ministry, I thought of stewardship as being a time where we would raise funds in a very proficient way to meet budgets and provide ministries. And I realized that while all that is good and important, to be a follower of Christ means that we allow our hearts to have their say. And what we want, what our hearts want to do is they want to do something that expresses the gratitude and the love of this God who has poured out, keeps pouring out this never-ending love for God, a love that will never, ever let us go. And I began to realize that maybe at its heart, stewardship really is about doing a beautiful thing for God. Maybe it's about allowing God to say, you get it. You understand. It's not about figuring out what you can get by with, but allowing your heart to respond to me as my heart has already responded to you. And maybe in that exchange of gratitude, generosity, and recklessness, love forms a bond that draws us to God in ways that make all of this truly alive. It is to this God who has done a beautiful thing in pouring out love for us in Christ, who invites us to join in this strange dance of love, that we might find ourselves being so motivated, so compelled by God's goodness that we can't choose to respond to God in any way except for what the heart cries out for. And may our hearts be heard and our hearts obeyed as we consider what it means indeed to be the people of God. And it is to this God that we give all praise and honor and glory today, tomorrow, and indeed forevermore.